Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. So it's a regularly scheduled weekly episode where we are going to pick one board game. We're going to talk about how to play it. We're going to talk about the strategies in the game. And then we're going to talk about how it was designed. So Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Tiny Towns, designed by Peter McPherson and published in 2019 by AEG. So it's a really recent game.
Yep. And we played this one at Geekway. Well, specifically, you played it at Geekway. Yeah. And this is one of the games that you actually went and picked up your own copy of.
Yeah, like immediately. It's the only game I picked up my own copy of, actually, right. So far, yeah.
There's a couple that I have on my list that I haven't gotten to yet. But yes, it's saying something that you got it so quickly, so soon after Geekway. So this Tiny Towns, just to give a short description of what the game is about. In Tiny Towns, players are architects tasked with plotting towns for their fellow woodland citizens. Each turn, one player takes the role of master builder and declares a material which all players must take a cube of and place on an empty square in their 4x4 city grid. The master builder role then passes clockwise to the next player. At any point in a turn, a player may return cubes from their town to the cube supply to construct a building, as long as the cubes were the correct colors and in the correct arrangement to that building's particular plot. That building must be placed in one of the squares that was occupied by a cube that you just returned. At any point, a player may also drop out from building, meaning they no longer receive cubes and they can no longer construct buildings. Once each player has dropped out, the game ends. The points gained from buildings are calculated. The points from empty spaces are subtracted, and the player with the most points wins. So that is the short description of what Tiny Towns is about. Essentially, one player will declare a cube, a color of cube, which represents a type of resource, and every player must take that color cube and put it in their town, and then they combine these cubes in very particular arrangements and color combinations to construct buildings in their town.
Right.
So there's not much else to describe when it comes to the gameplay, because that's pretty much it. It's pretty simple. I guess we could say that there are four. So there's how many different types of buildings are there? Because you play with a limited set of kinds of buildings.
There is always one building that is the same every time, which is the cottage.
Right.
Then there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 other types of buildings, of which there are 4 different versions of that you could possibly play with. You kind of randomize all of the other types of buildings in the pool of buildings.
And do you think you could give like a short description, like the color of the building and in general what that building will do?
So the cottage is blue, and the cottage gives you points if it's fed. The red buildings are like farming buildings that will feed cottages. Whoops. The yellow buildings are like commerce buildings, and they're one of the best ones for getting points, along with the green buildings, which are more like hospitality buildings, like inns and taverns and stuff. And those tend to give you more points for the quantity of green buildings, whereas the yellow gives you more points based on positioning. There's also orange, which are religious buildings, and those tend to be a little harder to get points from, but still one of the main scoring buildings. There are black, which are like industrial buildings, and these all have some form of utility, like being able to use or being able to place resources on them that you don't want to place on your board. And then there is gray, which is like very, very basic utility buildings, and these are always the smallest in terms of the number of resources required, and therefore the spaces that it takes to build them in, if that makes sense.
Right. They're kind of gap fillers.
Right.
They're not a major source of points. They're just kind of a way to fill up some space, because empty spaces are worth negative points at the end of the game.
Right.
So it's better just to have these small buildings than have nothing at all.
Right. Additionally,
yeah, go ahead.
Each player is given 2 of these magenta buildings called the Monument, and you choose one of these at the start of the game to keep. The other one gets a discard, put back in the box, whatever. And at any point, you can build this building, you know, as just one of the ones on your board, but you can only do that once, because each player only has one monument to place. And these tend to have special effects, special rules.
They're all unique.
Yeah.
And completely different from any other type of building. And you can't build the monuments that your opponents have. You only have access to your monument that you were dealt and that you chose.
Right.
At the beginning of the game.
A few extra notes on the rules are, first of all, there is a special rule that you can do if, like, you're playing with new players or if you just want it a little easier, where twice during the game, when a player names a resource, then you don't want to place it, you can put it into a cavern where it's not anything against you. So it just gives you, like, two free gimmies, so to speak.
Right.
And then, additionally, there are these resource cards that are used in both the solo variant and in a different multiplayer variant that we have not played, where you draw these resource cards and they tell you which resources to place. But those are optional.
Gotcha.
Right.
So, and just to describe these schematics that you have to match, and to describe the types of resources there are, there's five different types of resources that are gray, which represents stone. There's brown, which represents wood. There is blue, which represents glass. There's red, which represents brick. And there's yellow, which represents straw.
Wheat? It's specifically wheat.
Wheat. Okay. So it's not really a building material. It's more like
food.
Food. Interesting. Okay. Every turn you pick one of those five materials to put it on your board. Then the types of arrangements you can expect. I think the gray one, is that one always just a gray and a brown, or is it sometimes
It's always combination? Two size, meaning it's just two squares next to each other.
Right.
It looks like I'm looking through the different things right now. It looks like they are always gray and a brown.
Gotcha. Okay. So that's that. The cottage is the same card every game and it has the same effect. And that one is always a blue with a yellow and a red cube making an L shape off of it.
It should be noted that while these different schematics are shown in like an order, you can rotate and flip that schematic. So in this case, it's shown with the red on one side of the blue and the yellow on the other side. But you could switch it to, like, instead of the red being on the left, it's the yellow on the left and the red on top. The only thing you can't do is rearrange the order these are in. So, like, you can't have the blue on the outside and then red and yellow, if that makes sense.
Right. Right. You couldn't have the blue on one of the wings and the red in the center. Right. It always has to be a blue in the center and then a yellow and a red on the wings. So you can rotate, you can flip, but you can't shuffle the colors around.
Right.
So after the cottage, I think the only other one that costs three cubes will be the hospitality type of house.
Yeah.
And those are usually in a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are also usually just two colors. So you'll have two cubes of one color.
There is one that requires three different colors.
Gotcha. So then after that, everything starts to cost four. Some of the more simple magenta cards cost four cubes.
Some even cost three.
Right. The food building costs four.
The religious building and the
religious building costs four.
And like the commerce trade buildings cost four.
Right. And then it goes up to six. I think the black building, the industry building, that one costs five always. And then your magenta building can cost anywhere from four to six. And they can be in all kinds of arrangements and layouts.
Yeah.
So what's the strategy for this game? Where do you start when you first deal out all the cards and you see all the different buildings that you're working with?
So usually I would start by looking at, for one thing, what the red card is, because whether or not it's easy to feed your cottages can really impact your strategy. Because even though they do take three things, three resources, cottages are still pretty good filler, but you have to feed them with one of the red buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So what, how easy that is and how likely you can make the cottages filler is important. Other than that, I think usually looking at like a yellow building or a green building and trying to use one of those as your main scorer is really good, because those tend to give you a lot of points. Mm-hmm. If you specialize in them in some way, they're like the build arounds,
right?
There's also,
I think
you want to make sure you can use your magenta building because they're usually very strong.
Yeah, and you get to look at the buildings that are in the center of the table that everyone has access to as you're making your decision for what magenta card to choose for the game. So some, like, for an example of why that would matter, we played a game where the hospitality building was one where if you managed to get six of them in your town, then they were worth a lot of points. And I had a magenta building that I could choose from that allowed me to, when I constructed it, replace two of my buildings with two other buildings. And so I figured that was a very easy way of obtaining six of those hospitality buildings in the game. Yeah. So that's just one example of a combo. Personally, the first thing that I look at when I look at all the buildings in the center is the cube to point value ratio for every building. Because we like to talk about turn efficiency in this podcast, and that's the easiest metric to judge from in this game is just saying, like, if I spend three cubes to build this building, how many points is it going to give me? And if it's three, then that's very good in this game. If it's less than three, then it depends how much less than three it is. Or if it takes four cubes, how much less than four is it giving me?
Right. So in Jeffrey's example with the hospitality building, each of those buildings required three cubes, and if you had six, it would give you 26, which makes each cube a little over 4 points per cube.
Yeah, which is an incredible rate. You would have to have at least, I think with that particular version of that building, you'd have to have at least four of them to break even.
Yeah.
Because I think in that case, the first one was worth negative points. The second one was worth, I think, 4 points. So
the second one gave you negative points.
No, the even numbers were the positives.
Oh, wait, you're right. So
the second one, I think, gave you 4 points, which is less than 1 point per cube. That's six cubes or 4 points. Then when you got to four of them, you broke even because you were at like 12. You were at. Yeah, 12 for 4.
You know what? I'm an idiot. It's not 4 points per cube. It's more like 2 something per cube, but yeah.
Either way, it was more than 1 point per cube, which doesn't happen very often in this game.
Yeah.
So when you can swing it, it's very useful.
Right.
So I like to look at that, but the other thing that I like to look at is I like to look at the colors on all of the buildings and the color cubes that work on all the buildings, because certain arrangements or certain types of buildings when combined together or that make up this like shop area can like there can be one very dominant color. And yeah. When that's the case, then that means you can kind of expect all of the other players to at least pick up that color sometimes more than any other given color. You can predict that one to show up. So building buildings that use those dominant colors in the field will mean that like more of your opponent's turns will be useful to you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's the main player interaction comes in choosing to place resources that other people don't want and trying to wait and not place resources that other people might choose so that you can mm-hmm. get it off their turns.
Right. This essentially comes from like the concept that we talk a lot about on this game, on this podcast, mm-hmm. which is if you can get extra turns are some of the most broken things you can have in a game. And in this game, an extra turn is basically when an opponent picks a cube that you would have picked on your turn.
Right. And technically, like, everybody's using the cubes that everybody calls out. So in a way, you're already getting an extra turn. Or everybody's getting extra turns, so to speak, but it's more like you're making the decision on what you want twice. in a mm-hmm. row or something.
But there's a little more to that as well, because so if somebody picks a cube that you definitely don't need, in some cases that can set you back a great deal. Like it can take away turns from you, because you'll have to spend turns getting rid of that cube by constructing it into a building that you don't want, just to get it out of the way. Or it just might go into a slot and never leave. And so it's kind of like a negative turn towards the end of the game that you could have taken to put a good cube there to finish a building. Now it's just a random cube on your board that you weren't able to use. So there's that. But then in addition, if your opponents are picking the cubes that you want, then you have a chance to take a cube that you kind of want, but a cube that your opponents do not want.
Right.
So it's kind of like you don't need to use your turn to take the thing that you absolutely need. You don't have that pressure on you when it's your turn. So you can take a slightly more relaxed turn that's more of like a counter pick to what your opponents are trying to do.
Right, yeah.
That's because your opponents are taking all the best moves for you. You don't have to worry about that.
Right, exactly. And in that regard, I say the biggest point of advice that's like really general is just have contingency plans. For in case anything messes up, like, if the gray building that needs two resources is something that requires you to build around it to get any points out of it, maybe try to keep a spot open just in case you need to build one of those gray buildings,
mm-hmm.
you know, or if you're going to build something that needs a lot of cubes, like one of the black buildings, then try to position them in a way where if something happens, you can sort of turn those into two other buildings.
Right. Or you can just build around them. Like sure. you're not building up into a corner or something and leaving some blank space, some wasted space.
Yeah.
This game kind of reminds me of Broom Service in this regard, because you cannot try to take the perfect route in this game. You can't say like, oh, I need to keep three spaces open for my cottage and I'm going to use these four spaces for my yellow building, because at any point during using those seven spaces, somebody might pick an odd cube that doesn't fit into either of those schematics, and if that's all you've got left, then you have to say goodbye to one of those two buildings. So planning for that, planning for just having a space for an odd cube, planning for having a space for an odd cube, and also planning for turning that cube into something because there's just enough space around it, are very important things in this game. You can't expect to everything to play out exactly the way you want,
right?
Because then you'll just doom yourself.
Exactly.
So the whole existence of this like schematic mechanic means that you have to be very careful with where you put your cubes and where you put your buildings, because if you don't pay attention, then you can section off parts of your board and make it impossible for anything to be built there, because like you need at least two spaces directly next to each other to build the smallest building. And so if you have just a single blank space on your board that's blocked in by other cubes or other buildings, then that space is just going to be blank for the rest of the game.
Yeah.
So, about the cubes, like they don't leave the board until you build something out of them. So if you were kind of designating a spot on your board to build out a schematic, then you get a random cube. You can't put it in any of the spaces where you were trying to build your other schematic. And if you do, you're going to have to build it into something and get it out of there.
Yeah. I think one way to look at this, at least the way I look at it, is sort of like direction of play, where like if you kind of think about like, here's where I want to build my first building, and then I want to build outward from there so that I don't leave any holes between buildings that I can't put anything in, or that I'm less likely to fit anything in. And then that way, like, you start in one corner. If somebody names a junk piece, you can try to fit it in the other corner into a place where it can be put into a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess not directly in the corner, but you get it. Just, like, start on one side and move towards the other side is how I'd put it.
Now, It's optional whether or not you convert your cubes into a building right away. And that was relevant to me in one of the games because my my obelisk, is that what it's called?
Monument.
My monument had a lot of overlap with its schematic with another building. So I essentially was able to arrange cubes to the point where I could have built either of them. And I just kind of left it there because I didn't have any reason to build either one of those. And eventually there came a point where it was like, one of them was that thing that let me convert my buildings into other buildings. And the other one was the food building that would have fed my cottages, but I didn't have any cottages. So I didn't have a reason to build a food building because I didn't know where my cottages were going to go. And I didn't have a reason to build the other building because I didn't really have two buildings to convert yet. So I just kind of let it go and it wasn't in the way. And eventually there came a time when I had to do it. And it made more sense to do it then. If mm-hmm. I had done it too soon, I may have put my building in an odd location on my board that may have gotten in the way of other schematics throughout the game.
Yeah. All right. Do you have any more strategy tips?
That's all that I have, really. Just mostly pay attention to the points per cube. Remember that, technically the cottages are more than, or they're less than 1 point per cube because they give you 3 points for 3 cubes, but you have to build a 4 cube building to feed them.
Yeah.
So those actually will never, because the food buildings don't give you points. They just feed your cottages. So they won't likely ever get to the 1-to-1. So try to get that, and then pay attention to the common cubes and then pay very close attention to where you can build as you are placing cubes and buildings on your board.
Right.
All right. So shall we talk about the design?
Yes, let's do that.
Where do we start?
So this game is a game that is all about claustrophobia, so to speak, in having very crowded placements. And I mean, so your board is a 4x4 grid, which mm-hmm. the exact size of that, I think, doesn't really sink in until you've already placed one or two buildings. Because, like, at the start, it's like, oh, there's so much room. But then you place one building in, like, the center, and you realize this whole corner is, like, a corridor that you have to be careful of.
Right, because after you get past the cottage, almost every other building is going to have at least one side that's 3 cubes long. I think there's a handful of buildings that are like a 4x4 square.
Yeah. But
even then, like a 4x4 square or a 3 cube long schematic, it's going to be very difficult to find that space on your board in the middle of the game.
Right, yeah. But it's like, I feel like the fact that it doesn't really feel like that closed off and that cramped until after like the first two buildings kind of helps on ramping. Mm-hmm. Like the sheer lack of space you have doesn't really sink in. And so the decisions feel a lot less tense those first few buildings. Right. And it doesn't feel as bad when people call out resources you don't want early game, which means that it won't feel as bad right off the bat and put you on tilt.
Yeah, it kind of introduces you to the problems that the obstacles you'll encounter in this game slowly as you play.
Right. It also means that... I remember
the first round I played, I went super fast and I built a bunch of buildings very quickly. And then somewhere in the middle of the game, I realized that I couldn't build anything else on my board. Just how I arranged my buildings the first time around, I left a bunch of blank spaces and I just had to call it quits there.
Right. It's also nice.
It wasn't great, but it wasn't terrible.
It's also nice that in a way it lets you decide on the first two buildings you build, but that sort of bit is entirely by consequence of the rules. It's not like a thing in the rule book that says, like, you know, you'll be able to choose whichever buildings you want for the first two, but then the real game starts. Or it's mm-hmm. not like the game starts easy and then it's like phase two, things get harder.
Mm-hmm.
It's all just
natural. I kind of want to talk a little bit more about that, because this game doesn't have, it doesn't have rounds or phases or
okay, technically steps. The rounds are whenever somebody new becomes the master builder, but yeah.
I mean, that's just a turn, though.
Yeah. Well, that's, it's called that's not a round.
It's called a round, yeah. But I mean, functionally, from what we understand, like a round is a collection of turns where everybody gets a turn.
Right.
And a turn is when it's one player's, like one designated player's time to do a certain thing.
Right.
I think so I think I, Jamie Stegmaier wrote a small piece about like abolishing rounds from gameplay, because they're just kind of like one extra arbitrary thing you have to keep up. It's like the easiest arbitrary thing you have to keep up with. But this game has none of them.
Yeah.
No rounds, nothing arbitrary that you have to remember to do, except, I guess, pass the hammer to the next player.
Yeah.
Which, as we found out, was actually kind of hard to remember to do.
Right.
But either way, it's just... like it's just turns until the game's over.
Right. Yeah. There's very little downtime. Well, there's no downtime really.
Yeah.
And even the lines between when you have to make a decision and when you'll next have to make a decision are so thin. It all just kind of blends together.
Yeah. I think for the player experience, this game is very, very fluid. More so than like a lot of other games.
Yeah.
Just because it doesn't have rounds and the turns are just so simple.
And you can still take as much time as you need. It's not like a real time game where, you know, there's a clock that's literally timing down.
Mm-hmm.
But because everybody's still kind of doing simultaneous actions, it just goes by really smoothly. And also, like, in that regard, not everybody is building a building every round. And the rounds in which players do build buildings are kind of spaced out enough just by the way the mechanics work for the schematics and everything that you don't often get like these huge wait times between rounds.
Right. Like, I think the biggest waiting period that exists in this game is when a player is forced to make a tough decision with a resource that they didn't want to take.
Yeah.
It's just like when you're down to, and that usually happens towards the end of the game when space is limited and you're leaving very specific spaces open to perform very specific schematics. And so you're given a choice essentially to abandon one of your schematics that you were kind of banking on finishing for the end of the game. That's the hardest decision you have to make that doesn't come around until the very end of the game. And it's pretty rare, because pretty shortly after that happens, the game is pretty much over, because it's like when that happens, that means you're probably down to like two schematics and you abandon one and then you finish your other one. And then that's pretty much it. You don't have any more room after that.
Right. So it's sort of like by the time a player has to take a lot of time on their turn, the game's really close to being done. So it
might even be the case that somebody is already ducked out at that point.
Yeah. So it doesn't take too long to like from the point in which people start to have harder decisions to the end of the game where you can either end or start a new game.
Right.
Which is good. I think like eliminating downtime is a worthwhile pursuit in game design as a whole right now. And
this
is a pretty good way of tackling that. I want to talk about indirect direct conflict.
Okay.
Which is a dumb term I just made up. So so in a lot of like very resource minded games, a lot of like Euro games and stuff, the conflict isn't direct. That's sort of like been classically one of the main distinguishers between Euro and Ameri-centric style.
Can you give an example of direct versus indirect conflict in a board game?
So indirect conflict is like both players are competing for the same pool of resources. So like in Dominion, both players are trying to get the same victory cards from the same stack of victory cards, or the same action cards that are very strong from those same action card pools. You're not actually doing something to the other player, it's just that you're competing from the same source, and only one person can get the most of the pie. But direct conflict is when you are directly impacting another player through a decision you make straight to that player, in using Dominion again, it would be an attack card that makes a player discard a card. It is, you are directly impacting somebody straight to a personal source or personal resource of theirs. Or, like, attacking a player to deal damage to them in, like, a trading card game. But so, in most of the more indirect conflict games, the player has to, like, figure out how to interact with the other player. So, like, in Catan, you kind of have to take an extra step to determine, like, oh, I could, like, block off their routes by placing settlements in certain positions so they either can't get past this or can't get this resource. It's like you have to kind of puzzle solve how you can interact with the other players. In Tiny Towns, from turn one, players are interacting with each other, but it happens automatically just by players deciding what they want to do for themselves. So it brings this like conflict and player interaction to the very start of the game, but the players don't have to like worry about it necessarily. So like the defender has all the experience and tension of having to manage other people's decisions that impact them, but there's no attacker who has to balance like either attacking somebody or getting their own resources. It's like all the good of the tough decision making without the time it takes and effort it takes to implement or like enact on an aggressive play. And it still has room for that aggressive play, but like you can get that even without having to try to play aggressively.
Right. It's it kind of like it, at least it takes like the personal feeling out of the direct conflict, even though it kind of is direct, where it's like, I mean, I'm just picking this because I need it and it's affecting you, but that's not necessarily my fault. Do like how at the beginning of the game, as long as your opponent isn't making their magenta building, then every cube that you didn't plan on taking is at least building to something, because your opponents are trying to build something with those cubes that you weren't planning on building. So you might as well just build along with them, you know?
Yeah.
In the beginning of the game. It's kind of cool that it's also just always on in this game.
Exactly.
It's like, it just becomes normal.
Yeah, it's, I think one thing I want to, like, say is that, like, for a lot of games, when you're designing a game, you can have this vision of, like, what the ideal play of the game would be, or the ideal state. Like the actions and play patterns players will do. And sometimes it can be hard to encourage players to do like the intended sort of interaction and conflict that you want. But this game, it puts it to that idealized state immediately just by the mechanics of what you're going to do for yourself. Yeah. Let's see. Another good thing I like, this is more of a personal thing, but I like the way the theming is done with the different types of buildings. So one thing about games like these is it can be hard to use components multiple times, or like reuse components for the same function. This game allows you to have a bunch of different building types with the same component, which is the, like, shape and color of building, by having them fulfill similar but different functions, and then having those functions be thematically similar but different. So, right. Like, it lets there be a variable amount of, a variable amount of boards and games where you'll have different things you're going for. But, for one thing, the fact that the colors and effects tend to match up the same and like fill in the same categories for each color and effect, like all the yellow ones are similar to each other in some way, all the green ones are similar to each other, it helps make reading the board easier every time. But it also just kind of it helps kind of keep things similar but different enough.
It is kind of interesting that any building of a given type will score points in a similar way.
Yeah.
So that means that the more important thing to notice when you're looking at the buildings that are being laid out is the colors of the cubes and how they're arranged.
Right. Yeah.
And when you're playing the game, that's almost something that's more important, that deserves more of your attention than how the points are earned. Because sure, you need the most points to win, but you can't earn points if you can't build anything. And that planning is very important in this game.
Right. It's almost like it lets you very easily skip the part where you try to see what all of the buildings that are available for this game does and go straight to, like, what's the easiest ones to build? What are the ones that will give me the most points? Like, it lets you skip a step because you've already learned how each one kind of generally works and how they generally score. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to say, like, oh, the red one does this. You already know the red one's going to feed. It might have a very, you know, a slightly different method of feeding cottages, but you can kind of keep going to the more important stuff afterwards.
Right.
Also, I think it's just implemented well.
Yeah. I like how pretty much every building except the factory building is just good in multiples.
Yeah.
For the most part, like any building, the cottage, except for the space filler, which is kind of obvious why not, but the cottage, the hospitality building, the market building, they're always just usually you just make a bunch of them. So if you focus on one thing, you'll turn out all right in the end.
Right. And the black buildings don't even want you to build multiples. Like, yeah. It's so hard to build multiples that as a player, you don't really care to do so.
Sure. Right. Yeah, that's true.
I do like that the gray buildings are filler and the component for them is just this flat octagon. So, like, they're the least interesting component. So if you were to look at it in terms of, like, what buildings do I want to make so that my board looks the coolest from, like, a aesthetically pleasing standpoint, you still don't want that many of these gray buildings.
Mm-hmm. It's also true that the buildings that take more resources to build are the most interesting looking, except for I don't think that the monument is as cool looking as it could be. But I guess it has to represent so many different things because there's like 30 unique monuments that,
yeah,
you know, what are they going to do except just make some kind of tower? At least it's different than anything else in the field. Everything else has like a steep roof.
Yeah. This one of the buildings, the black building, is one of the most neat components in any game I've played. So specifically, the black buildings, there are two of them that let you place resources on them when a player names a resource. Oh no, three of them do this. And the black building has these triangular indents in the top, and you can place the resource cubes on them like perfectly. And then the most resource cubes you might have on one of these is three. And so there's two of these triangular indents, and then it also is stable enough for you to fit a third cube between them. It's like, it's so neat.
I'm not sure that that's intentional.
I don't know.
In this game. I guess it is kind of coincidental that they do have like right angle notches and you can fit these cubes, which are all right angles into them.
It feels like too much of a coincidence because the most that you'll ever have on one of these is three, and it has just enough to make three stably.
I'm just hesitant to believe that conspiracy because it's a factory, you know, so it's, I think the common image of a factory is like multiple peaks to a roof, like in a flat arrangement.
Right. I could have sworn, oh, no, in the rule book, there's literally an image of the black building having three cubes on it.
Oh, well, there you go. Very cool, then.
Yeah. I was going to say, I could have sworn they actually show you to do it in the rule book.
All right, yeah. That's pretty neat. That they obtained, or they achieved that level of kind of interlockingness with wooden pieces. Usually you don't see that with wooden pieces.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, like, do you have anything to say design-wise?
I think the illustrations look good. The colors are good.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I just kind of want to say that this game is the closest thing to a gateway game that we've reviewed on this podcast in a while.
Yeah, kind of.
I think it shares a lot of qualities that a gateway game would have. It's got entirely open information. You can see everything that's available to you from the very first turn. And you can see what your opponents are doing from the first turn. There's nothing hidden.
Well, there's one thing hidden.
Which is players' unique buildings. But that's hardly relevant to you.
Yeah.
There's only like three rules. It's very simple. There's no rounds.
Yeah, the
it's
rules just are
turns until the game's over. The interaction is indirect for the most part.
And even then, people's actions can still help you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like a weird, like, semi-competitive, but you can also indirectly help people. And trying to find ways where other players can help you is very important, which is really neat.
Right. It's a fast-paced game, but there's a lot in it to master. You know, the ability to read what your opponents are planning on doing and then preparing for that.
You can also kind of steal what other people are doing.
Sure, yeah. Because it's open, it's like Dominion.
Yeah.
You can see what other people's strategies are and you can kind of mimic them.
Yeah.
You can mimic them as they're developing them because you're taking all the same pieces as they are.
Yeah, I think this fits all of those gateway game clauses.
I think maybe the only thing that it has going against it is that it can be very punishing.
Yeah.
Like super punishing. Like if you're not careful, you can section off entire, even just one building in the wrong spot can prevent you from building like five options of buildings near it just because it's blocking off too much of the board.
And there's like no catch up mechanics.
Right there. Yes. Well, although, how do you really get ahead in this game? It depends on your magenta building, I think.
You get ahead by planning and using what you get efficiently.
If you have like perfect reads, then you can build like one more building than your opponents do every four turns, maybe.
Sure.
I guess. But that's with like perfect planning. I think even the inexperienced player will still be able to keep up because they'll be building buildings with the stuff that you're picking up. Anyways, I'm thinking it's just that punishing. I guess you can't come back from that. You can't catch up from that. There's nothing for you.
Yeah.
If you lay out your buildings wrong. But it's a fast game. And if you lay out your buildings wrong, that just means you're going to have to duck out. You don't have to like sit there and necessarily suffer. You do have to wait until everyone's done building their buildings, and that's a form of suffering, but it's not like you're forced to dig your grave any deeper.
Right. It is also true that by the time one player is done, both the other existing players have fewer tough choices to make because they'll have more often make the decision they want. So it's a game where like once one player gets knocked out, it very naturally leads to the end of the game very quickly.
Right. Things do pick up by a lot. It's more than just like skipping a turn.
Yeah. All right.
That's all I have to say about the design.
Yeah, same for me.
All right. Then is there any game similar to Tiny Towns that you can recommend?
Most of Uwe Rosenberg's games he's been putting out recently. Like
right. we
Indian
also played,
Summer and Cottage Garden and Spring Meadow.
Yeah, we played Spring Meadow at Geekway as well, and it has some similarities to this game.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a game without rounds.
Yeah.
Azul. Yeah, that's a very similar game as well.
A lot of tile placement games, Carcassonne, you know. Yeah.
Okay. So if you like any of those games, you'll probably like Tiny Towns. And if you check out Tiny Towns, you want to check something else out, you can check those games out. And with that, that will be the end of our episode on Tiny Towns. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you like, you can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. We put out little questions for our listeners. We post updates on our episodes. We give little teasers for upcoming episodes, so you can check us out there. You can hit us with some feedback there if you like. If there's a game you want us to check out, you can let us know there, and we'll check it out for you.
Yeah, so far we've done one episode that was suggested by a listener.
Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting game. If you like, you can also follow us on any podcasting platform and leave us reviews there. We have a website. You can go to bgbcast.com, and that's where we have all of our episodes posted and tagged with all the games that we've mentioned in them. And we've done episodes on Azul. We mentioned Broom Service in this episode. We mentioned Carcassonne in this episode. So if you want to hear our thoughts on those, you can find the tags on our website, and that'll take you to the episodes that we did on them. You can also find a link on our website to our TeePublic store. That is teepublic.com/user/BGBcast. And that is where we have our cool merch with our cool logo on it. You can get that shirt and look very cool wearing it.
And let us know if there's any other types of shirts or clothing that you want our logo on that you would love to wear and buy.
Yep, let us know. And that'll do it for BG Bros plugs. So let's hear it for Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak. I usually stream from 11 a.m. Central to 2 p.m. Central time on weekdays. I've been having some issues lately, but I stream when I can. And if you want to follow me on Twitch or visit the Discord server in the description of my Twitch page, you will get notified whenever I go live. I usually stream fighting games, difficult platformers, roguelites, a lot of indie games. I speedrun a bit, a whole bunch of different type of stuff. So if you go there, you can chat with me about game design, and you can also visit that Discord server to chat with us about various types of stuff. And additionally, I write articles on the BGBcast website under the Episodes and Articles tab. My most recent article was about Enter the Gungeon and its thematic design. I haven't been able to upload a new one yet. I've been writing a whole bunch of stuff and working on a very, very long form analysis recently. But I will definitely tweet out an update and post and whatever about whatever next article I release. So yeah.
All right. And that does it for Matt Plugs, and that does it for our episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.